Chapter 19. The Dalai Lama is only 8 standard years old. I had known that. Ania and Abetic and Theo and Rachel have all mentioned it more than once. But I am still surprised when I see the child sitting on his high, cushioned throne. There must be 3,000 or 4,000 people in the immense reception room. Several broad escalators disgorge guests simultaneously into an antechamber the size of a spacecraft hangar, gold pillars rising to a frescoed ceiling 20 meters above us, blue and white tiles underfoot, with elaborate inset images from the Bardo Thodrol, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, as well as illustrations of the vast seedship migration of the Buddhist Old Earth emigres. Huge gold arches under which we pass to enter the reception room. And the reception room is larger still, its ceiling one giant skylight, through which the broiling clouds and flickering lightning and lantern-lit mountainside are quite visible. The 3,000 or 4,000 guests are brilliant in their finery. Flowing silk, sculpted linen, draped in dyed wool, profusions of red, black, and white feathers, elaborate hairdos, subtle but beautifully formed bracelets, necklaces, anklets, earrings, tiaras, and belts of silver, amethyst, gold, jade, lapis lazuli, and a score of other precious metals. And scattered among all this elegance and finery are scores of monks and abbots in their simple robes of orange, gold, yellow, saffron, and red, their closely shaved heads gleaming in the light from 100 flickering tripod braziers. Yet the room is so large that these few thousand people do not come close to filling it up. The parquet floors gleam in the firelight, and there is a 20-meter space between the first fringes of the crowd and the golden throne. Small horns blow as the lines of guests step from the escalator staircases to the anteroom tiles. The trumpets are of brass and bone, and the line of monks blowing them runs from the stairs to the entrance arches, more than 60 meters of constant noise. The hundreds of horns hold one note for minutes on end, and then shift to another low note without signal from trumpeter to trumpeter. And as we enter the main reception hall, the antechamber acting as a giant echo chamber behind us, these low notes are taken up and amplified by 24-meter longhorns on either side of our procession. The monks who blow these monstrous instruments stand in small alcoves in the walls, resting the giant horns on stands set on the parquet floors, the bell horn ends curling up like meter-wide lotus blossoms. Added to this constant low series of notes, rather like an ocean-going ship's foghorn wrapped within a glacier's rumble, are the reverberations of a huge gong at least 5 meters across being struck at precise intervals. The air smells of incense from the braziers, and the slightest veil of fragrant smoke moves above the jeweled and coiffed heads of the guests and seems to shimmer and shift with the rise and fall of the notes from the trumpets and horns and gong. All faces are turned toward the Dalai Lama, his immediate retinue, and his guests. I take Ania's hand as we move to our right, staying far back from the throne and its surrounding dais. Constellations of important guests move nervously between us and the distant throne. Suddenly, the deep horn notes cease. The gong's final vibrations echo and fall away. All of the guests are present. The huge doors behind us are pushed shut by straining servants. Across the giant, echoing space, I can hear the crackling of flames in the countless braziers. Rain suddenly beats at the crystal skylight far above us. The Dalai Lama is smiling slightly as he sits cross-legged on multiple silk cushions atop a platform that brings him to eye level with his standing guests. The boy's head is bare and shaven, and he wears a simple red lama's robe. To his right, and lower, on a throne of his own, sits the regent who will rule, in consultation with other high priests, until His Holiness the Dalai Lama comes of age at 18 standard years. Ania has told me about this regent, a man named Retting Tokra, who is said to be the literal incarnation of cunning. But all I can see from my distant vantage point now is the usual red robe and a narrow, pinched, brown face with its slitted eyes and tiny mustache. To the left of His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the Lord Chamberlain, Abbot of Abbots. This man is quite old and smiling broadly at the phalanxes of guests. To his left is the state oracle, a thin young woman with severely cropped hair and a yellow linen shirt under her red robe. Anea has explained that it is the state oracle's job to predict the future while in a deep trance. To the left of the state oracle, their faces largely blocked from my view by the gilded pillars of the Dalai Lama's throne, stand five emissaries from the Pax. I can make out a short man in cardinal's red, three forms in black cassocks, and at least one military uniform. To the right of the regent's throne stands the chief crier and head of His Holiness's security, the legendary Carl Linga William Eheji, Zen archer, watercolorist, karate master, philosopher, former flyer, and flower arranger. Eheji looks to be built of coiled steel, wrapped about with pure muscle, as he strides forward and fills the immense hall with his voice.
Honored guests, visitors from beyond our world, Dukpas, Drukpas, Drongpas, those from the highest ridges, the noble fishers and the wooded valley slopes, Zazas, honored officials, the red hats and the yellow hats, monks, abbots, Getzel novices, Kosas of the fourth rank and higher, blessed ones who wear the sugi, wives and husbands of those so honored, seekers of enlightenment, it is my pleasure to welcome you here tonight on behalf of His Holiness, Getswang Nguang Lobsang Tengin Gyapso Sisinwangyur Chungpa Mapai Depal Sangpo. The Holy One, the gentle glory, powerful in speech, pure in mind, of divine wisdom, holding the faith ocean-wide. The small brass and bone trumpets blow high, clear notes. The great horns bellow like dinosaurs. The gong sends vibrations through our bones and teeth. Chief Crier Eheji steps back. His Holiness the Dalai Lama speaks, his child's voice soft but clear and firm across the great space.
Thank you all for coming this night. We shall greet our new friends from the Pax in more intimate circumstances. Many of you have requested to see me. You shall receive my blessing in private audience tonight. I have requested to speak with some of you. You shall meet me in private audience tonight. Our friends from the Pax will speak with many of you this evening and in the days to come. In speaking to them, please remember that these are our brothers and sisters in the Dharma, in the quest for enlightenment. Please remember that our breath is their breath, and that all of our breath is the breath of Buddha. Thank you. Please enjoy our celebration this night.
And with that, the dais, throne and all, slides silently back through the opening wall, is hidden by a sliding curtain, then by another curtain, and then by the wall itself. And the thousands in the main reception hall let out a breath, as one. The evening was, as I remember, a nearly surreal combination of a gala ball swirling around a formal papal reception. I had never seen a papal reception, of course. The mystery cardinal on the now curtained dais was the highest official of the church encountered in my experience. But the excitement of those being received by the Dalai Lama must have been similar to a Christian meeting the Pope. And the pomp and circumstance surrounding their presentation was impressive. Soldier monks in red robes and red or yellow hats escorted the lucky few through the tented curtains and then through more curtains and finally through the door in the wall to the Dalai Lama's presence, while the rest of us moved and mixed across the torch-lit parquet floor, or browsed the long tables of excellent food, or even danced to the music of a small band. No brass and bone trumpets or 4-meter horns there. I admit that I asked Anea if she would like to dance, but she smiled, shook her head, and led our group to the nearest banquet table. Soon we were engaged in conversation with the Dorji Famo and some of her female priests. Knowing that I might be committing a faux pas, I nonetheless asked the beautiful old woman why she was called the Thunderbolt Sow. As we munched on fried balls of tsampa and drank delicious tea, the Dorji Famo laughed and told us the story. On old Earth, the first such abbess of an all-male Tibetan Buddhist monastery had gained the reputation of being the reincarnation of the original Thunderbolt Sow, a demigoddess of frightening power. That first Dorji Famo abbess was said to have transformed not only herself, but all of the lamas in her monastery into pigs to frighten away enemy soldiers. When I asked this last reincarnation of the Thunderbolt Sow if she had retained the power of transforming into a sow, the elegant old woman lifted her head and said firmly, "If that would frighten away these current invaders, I would do so in an instant." In the 3 hours or so during which Ania and I mixed and chatted and listened to music and watched the lightning through the grand skylight, this was the only negative thing we heard spoken, aloud, about the Pax emissaries. Although under the silk finery and gala gaiety, there seemed to be an undercurrent of anxiety to the evening. This seemed natural, since the world of Tian Shan had been, except for the occasional free trader's dropship, isolated from the Pax and the rest of post-hegemony humanity for almost 3 centuries. The evening was growing late, and I was becoming convinced that Lobsang Samten's statement that the Dalai Lama and his Pax guests had wished to see us was erroneous, when suddenly several palace officiaries in great, curved red and yellow hats, looking rather like illustrations I had seen of ancient Greek helmets, sought us out and asked that we accompany them to the Dalai Lama's presence. I looked at my friend, ready to bolt with her and cover our retreat if she showed even a hint of fear or reticence, but Ania simply nodded in compliance and took my arm. The sea of partygoers made way for us as we crossed the vast space behind the officials, the two of us walking slowly, arm in arm, as if I were her father giving her away in a traditional church wedding, or as if we had always been a couple ourselves. In my pocket was the flashlight laser and the Disky Journal comm unit. The laser would be worth little if the Pax was determined to seize us, but I had decided to call the ship if the worst happened. Rather than allow Ania to be captured, I would bring the ship down on blazing reaction thrusters right through that lovely skylight. We passed through the outer curtain and entered a canopied space where the sounds of the band and merrymaking were still quite audible. Here, several red hat officials asked us to extend our arms with our palms upward. When we did so, they set a white silk scarf in our hands, the ends hanging down. We were waved forward through the second curtain. Here the Lord Chamberlain greeted us with a bow, Ania responding with a graceful curtsy, me with an awkward bow in return, and led us through the door into the small room where the Dalai Lama waited with his guests. This private room was like an extension of the young Dalai Lama's throne. Gold and gilt and silk brocade and wildly ornate tapestries with reversed swastikas embroidered everywhere, amid images of opening flowers and curling dragons and spinning mandalas. The doors closed behind us and the sounds of the party would have been shut out completely except for the audio pickups of 3 video monitors set in the wall to our left. Real-time video of the party was being fed in from different locations around the main reception hall, and the boy on the throne and his guests were watching it raptly. We paused until the Lord Chamberlain gestured us forward again. He whispered to us as we approached the throne and the Dalai Lama turned in our direction.
"It is not necessary to bow until His Holiness raises his hand. Then please bow forward until after he releases his touch."
We paused 3 paces from the raised throne platform with its shimmering quilts and draped cushions. Carl Lingo William Ihaji, the chief crier, said in soft but resonant tones,
"Your Holiness, the architect in charge of construction at Swan Kung Su and her assistant."
Her assistant? I moved forward a step behind Ania, confused but grateful that the crier had not announced our names. I could see the 5 Pax figures out of the corner of my eye, but protocol demanded that I keep my gaze directed toward the Dalai Lama, but lowered. Ania stopped at the edge of the high throne platform, her arms still held in front of her, the scarf taut between her hands. The Lord Chamberlain set several objects on the scarf, and the boy reached forward and whisked them off quickly, setting them to his right on the platform. When the objects were gone, a servant stepped forward and took away the white scarf. Ania put her hands together as if in prayer and bowed forward. The boy's smile was gentle as he leaned forward and touched my friend, my beloved, on the head, setting his fingers like a crown on her brown hair. I realized that it was a blessing. When he removed his fingers, he lifted a red scarf from a stack by his side and set it in Ania's left hand. Then he took her right hand and shook it, his smile broadening. The Lord Chamberlain gestured for Ania to stand in front of the regent's lower throne as I stepped forward and went through the same quick ceremony with the Dalai Lama. I just had time to notice that the object set on the white scarf by the Lord Chamberlain and whisked away by the Dalai Lama included a small gold relief in the shape of three mountains, representing the world of Tian Shan, Ania later explained, an image of a human body, a stylized book representing speech, and a chorten or temple shape representing the mind. The appearing and disappearing act was over before I had time to pay more attention to it, and then the red scarf was in one hand while the boy's tiny hand was in my large one. His handshake was surprisingly firm. My gaze was lowered, but I could still make out his broad smile. I stepped back next to Ania. The same ceremony was quickly performed with the regent. White scarf, symbolic objects placed and removed, red scarf. But the regent did not shake hands with either of us. When we had received the regent's blessing, the Lord Chamberlain gestured for us to raise our heads and gazes. I almost made a grab for the flashlight laser and started firing wildly. Besides the Dalai Lama, his monk servants, the Lord Chamberlain, the regent, the state oracle, the crier, the short cardinal, the three men in black cassocks, there was a woman in a black and red Pax Fleet uniform. She had just stepped around a tall priest so we could see her face for the first time. Her dark eyes were fixed on Ania. The woman's hair was short and hung over her pale forehead in limp bangs. Her skin was sallow. Her gaze was reptilian, simultaneously remote and rapt. It was the thing that had tried to kill Ania, Abetic, and me on God's Grove, some 5 of my years, more than 10 of Ania's, ago. It was the inhuman killing device that had defeated the Shrike and would have carried Ania's head away in a bag had it not been for the intervention of Father Captain DeSoya in his orbiting spacecraft. He had used the full fusion power of the ship to lance the monster downward into a cauldron of bubbling molten rock. And here it was again, its black, inhuman eyes fixed on Ania's face. It had obviously sought her across the years and light years, and now it had her. It had us. My heart was pounding and my legs felt suddenly weak, but through the shock my mind was working like an AI. The flashlight laser was tucked in a pocket in the right side of my cape. The comm unit was in my left trouser pocket. With my right hand, I would flash the cutting beam into the woman thing's eyes, then flick the selector to broad and blind the Pax priests. With my left hand, I would trigger the squirt command to send the pre-recorded message via tight beam to the ship. But even if the ship responded immediately and was not intercepted by a Pax warship on its flight, it would be several minutes before it could descend through the palace skylight. We would be dead by then. And I knew the speed of this thing. It simply had disappeared when it fought the Shrike, a chrome blur. I would never get the flashlight laser or comm unit out of my pockets. We would be dead before my hand made it halfway to the weapon. I froze, realizing that although Ania must have recognized the woman at once, she had not reacted with the shock I felt. To outward appearances, she had not reacted at all. Her smile remained. Her gaze had passed over the Pax visitors, including the monster, and then returned to the boy on the throne. It was Regent Retting Tokra who spoke first.
"Our guests asked for this audience. They heard from His Holiness of the reconstruction going on at the temple hanging in air, and wished to meet the young woman who had designed the construction."
The regent's voice was as pinched and unforgiving as his appearance. The Dalai Lama spoke then, and his boy's voice was soft, but as generous as the regent's had been guarded. "My friends," he said, gesturing toward Ania and me, "may I introduce our distinguished visitors from the Pax? Don Domenico Cardinal Mustafa of the Catholic Church's Holy Office, Archbishop Jean-Daniel Breck of the Papal Diplomatic Corps,
Father Martin Farrell, Father Gerard LeBlanc, and Commander Radamanth Nemes of the Noble Guard.
We nodded. The pack's dignitaries, including the monster, nodded. If there was a breach of protocol by His Holiness the Dalai Lama doing the introductions, no one seemed to notice. John Domenico, Cardinal Mustafa, said in a silken voice,
"Thank you, Your Holiness. But you have introduced these exceptional people only as the architect and her assistant."
The Cardinal smiled at us, showing small, sharp teeth.
"You have names, perhaps?"
My pulse was racing. The fingers of my right hand twitched at the thought of the flashlight laser. Anea was still smiling, but showed no sign of answering the Cardinal. My mind galloped to come up with aliases. But why? Certainly they knew who we were. All this was a trap. The Nemes thing would never let us leave this throne room, or would be waiting for us when we did. Surprisingly, it was the boy Dalai Lama who spoke again.
"I would be pleased to complete my introductions, Your Eminence. Our esteemed architect is called Ananda, and her assistant, one of many skilled assistants, I am told, is called Supada."
I admit that I blinked at this. Had someone told the Dalai Lama these names? Anea had told me that Ananda had been the Buddha's foremost disciple and a teacher in his own right. Supada had been a wandering ascetic who had become the Buddha's last direct disciple, becoming a follower after meeting him just hours before he died. She also told me that the Dalai Lama had come up with these names for our introduction, apparently appreciating the irony in them. I failed to see the humor.
"Emananda," said Cardinal Mustafa, bowing slightly. "M. Supada?"
He looked us over.
"You will pardon my bluntness and ignorance, Emananda, but you seem of a different racial stock than most of the people we have met in the Potala, or the surrounding areas of Tian Shan."
Anea nodded. "One must be careful in making generalizations, Your Eminence. There are areas of this world settled by seedship colonists from many of Old Earth's regions."
"Of course," purred Cardinal Mustafa. "And I must say that your web English is very unaccented. May I inquire as to which region of Tian Shan you and your assistant call home?"
"Of course," responded Anea, in as smooth a voice as the Cardinal's. "I came into the world in a region of ridges beyond Mount Moriah and Mount Zion, north and west of Mustakh Alta." The Cardinal nodded judiciously. I noticed then that his collar, what Anea later said was called his rabat or rabbi in church terminology, was of a scarlet watered silk, the same color as his red cassock and skullcap.
"Are you perchance," he continued smoothly, "of the Hebrew or Muslim faiths, which our hosts have told us prevail in those regions?"
"I am of no faith," said Anea. "If one defines faith as belief in the supernatural." The Cardinal's eyebrows lifted slightly. The man called Father Farrell glanced at his boss. Radamanth Nemes's terrible gaze never wavered.
"Yet you labor to build a temple to Buddhist beliefs," said Cardinal Mustafa pleasantly enough.
"I was hired to reconstruct a beautiful complex," said Anea. "I am proud to have been chosen to this task."
"Despite your lack of, belief in the supernatural?" said Mustafa.
I could hear the inquisition in his voice. Even on the rural moors of Hyperion we had heard of the Holy Office. "Perhaps because of it, Your Eminence," said Anea. "And because of the trust in my own human abilities and those of my co-workers."
"So the task is its own justification?" pressed the Cardinal. "Even if it has no deeper significance?"
"Perhaps a task well done is the deeper significance," said Anea. Cardinal Mustafa chuckled. It was not an altogether pleasant sound.
"Well said, young lady, well said."
Father Farrell cleared his throat.
"The region beyond Mount Zion," he said musingly. "We noticed during our orbital survey that there was a single Farcaster portal set onto a ridgeline in that area. We had thought that Tian Shan had never been a part of the web, but our records showed that the portal was completed very shortly before the fall." "But never used," exclaimed the young Dalai Lama, lifting one slim finger. No one ever traveled to or from the mountains of heaven via the hegemony Farcaster.
Indeed, said Cardinal Mustafa softly. Well, we assumed as much, but I must tender our apologies, Your Holiness. In our ship's zeal to probe the structure of the old Farcaster portal from orbit, it accidentally melted the surrounding rocks onto it. The doorway is sealed forever under rock, I am afraid. I glanced at Radamanth Nemes when this was said. She did not blink. I had not seen her blink. Her gaze was riveted to Anea. The Dalai Lama swept his hand in a dismissive gesture.
It does not matter, Your Eminence. We have no use for a Farcaster portal which was never used. Unless your Pax has found a way to reactivate the Farcasters.
He laughed at the idea. It was a pleasant, boyish laugh, but sharp with intelligence. No, Your Holiness, said Cardinal Mustafa, smiling. Even the Church has not found a way to reactivate the web, and it is almost certainly best that we never do. My tension was quickly turning to a sort of nausea. This ugly little man in cardinal red was telling Anea that he knew how she had arrived on Tian Shan, and that she could not escape that way. I glanced at my friend, but she seemed placid and only mildly interested in the conversation. Could there be a second Farcaster portal of which the Pax knew nothing? At least this explained why we were still alive. The Pax had sealed Anea's mousehole and had a cat, or several cats, in the form of their diplomatic ship in orbit, and undoubtedly more warships hidden elsewhere in system, waiting for her. If I had arrived a few months later, they would have seized or destroyed our ship and still had Anea where they wanted her. But why wait, and why this game?
We would be very interested in seeing your, what is it called, temple hanging in air? It sounds fascinating,
Archbishop Breck was saying. Regent Tok'ra was frowning.
It may be difficult to arrange, Your Excellency, he said. The monsoons are approaching. The cableways will be very dangerous, and even the highway is hazardous during the winter storms.
Nonsense, cried the Dalai Lama, ignoring the scowl the thin-faced regent had turned in his direction. We will be happy to help arrange such an expedition, continued the boy. You must, by all means, see Swan Kung Su, and all of the Middle Kingdom, even to the Tai Shan, the great peak, where the 27,000-step stairway rises to the temple to the Jade Emperor and the Princess of the Azure Clouds.
Your Holiness,
murmured the Lord Chamberlain, his head bowed, but only after exchanging a parental glance with the regent.
I should remind you that the great peak of the Middle Kingdom can be reached by cableway only in the spring months, because of the high tide of the poisonous clouds. For the next 7 months, Tai Shan is inaccessible to the rest of the Middle Kingdom and the world.
The Dalai Lama's boyish smile disappeared. Not, I thought, out of petulance, but from displeasure at being patronized. When he spoke next, his voice had the sharp edge of command to it. I did not know many children, but I had known more than a few military officers, and if my experience was any guide, this boy would become a formidable man and commander.
Lord Chamberlain, said the Dalai Lama, I of course know of the closure of the cableway. Everyone knows of the closure of the cableway. But I also know that every winter season a few intrepid flyers make the flight from Sung Shan to the Great Peak. How else would we share our formal edicts with our friends among the faithful on Tai Shan? And some of the parawings can accommodate more than one flyer. Passengers even, yes?
The Lord Chamberlain was bowing so low that I was afraid that his forehead was going to scrape the formal tiles. His voice quavered.
Yes, yes, of course, Your Holiness, of course. I knew that you knew this, my lord, Your Holiness. I only meant to say.
Regent Tok'ra said sharply, I am sure that what the Lord Chamberlain meant to say, Your Holiness, is that although a few flyers make the voyage each year, many more die in the attempt. We would not want to put our honored guests in any danger.
The Dalai Lama's smile returned. But it was something older and more cunning, almost mocking, than the boy's smile of a few minutes earlier. He spoke to Cardinal Mustafa.
You are not afraid of dying, are you, Your Eminence? That is the entire purpose of your visit here, is it not? to show us the wonders of your Christian resurrection?
Not the sole purpose, Your Holiness, murmured the Cardinal. We come primarily to share the joyous news of Christ with those who wish to hear it, and also to discuss possible trade relations with your beautiful world. The Cardinal returned the boy's smile. And although the cross and the sacrament of resurrection are direct gifts from God, Your Holiness, it is a sad requirement that some portion of the body or the crucifer must be recovered for that sacrament to be given. I understand that no one returns from your sea of clouds.
No one, agreed the boy, with his smile widening.
Cardinal Mustafa made a gesture with his hands. Then perhaps we will limit our visit to the temple hanging in air and other accessible destinations, he said. There was a silence, and I looked at Ania again, thinking that we were about to be dismissed, wondering what the signal would be, thinking that the Lord Chamberlain would lead us out, feeling my arms go to goosebumps at the intensity of the Nemes thing's hungry gaze aimed at Ania, when suddenly Archbishop Jean-Daniel Breck broke the silence.
I have been discussing with His Highness Regent Tok'ra, he said to us as if we might settle some argument between them, how amazingly similar our miracle of resurrection is to the age-old Buddhist belief in reincarnation. Ah, said the boy on the golden throne, his face brightening as if someone had brought up a subject of interest to him. But not all Buddhists believe in reincarnation. Even before the migration to Tian Shan and the great changes in philosophy which have evolved here, not all Buddhist sects accepted the concept of rebirth. We know for a fact that the Buddha refused to speculate with his disciples on whether there was such a thing as life after death. Such questions, he said, are not relevant to the practice of the path and cannot be answered while bound by the restraints of human existence. Most of Buddhism, you see, gentlemen, can be explored, appreciated, and utilized as a tool toward enlightenment without descending into the supernatural.
The Archbishop looked nonplussed, but Cardinal Mustafa said quickly, Yet did not your Buddha say, and I believe that one of your scriptures holds these as his words, Your Holiness, but correct me immediately if I am wrong. There is an unborn, an unoriginated, an unmade, an uncompounded. Were there not, there would be no escape from the world of the born, the originated, the made, and the compounded. The boy's smile did not waver.
Indeed he did, Your Eminence. Very good. But are there not elements, as yet not completely understood, within our physical universe, bound by the laws of our physical universe, which might be described as unborn, unoriginated, unmade, and uncompounded?
None that I know of, Your Holiness, said Cardinal Mustafa affably enough. But then I am not a scientist, only a poor priest. Despite this diplomatic finesse, the boy on the throne seemed intent on pursuing the subject.
As we have previously discussed, Cardinal Mustafa, our form of Buddhism has evolved since we landed on this mountain world. Now it is very much filled with the spirit of Zen, and one of the great Zen masters of old earth, the poet William Blake, once said, Eternity is in love with the productions of time.
Cardinal Mustafa's fixed smile showed his lack of understanding. The Dalai Lama was no longer smiling. The boy's expression was pleasant but serious.
Do you think, perhaps, that M. Blake meant that time without ending is worthless time, Cardinal Mustafa? That any being freed from mortality, even God, might envy the children of slow time?
The Cardinal nodded but showed no agreement. Your Holiness, I cannot see how God could envy poor mortal humankind. Certainly God is not capable of envy. The boy's nearly invisible eyebrows shot up.
Yet is not your Christian God by definition omnipotent? Certainly he, she, it must be capable of envy.
Ah, a paradox meant for children, Your Holiness. I confess I am trained in neither logical apologetics nor metaphysics. But as a prince of Christ's church, I know from my catechism and in my soul that God is not capable of envy, especially not envy of his flawed creations.
Flawed? Said the boy.
Cardinal Mustafa smiled condescendingly, his tone that of a learned priest speaking to a child. Humanity is flawed because of its propensity for sin, he said softly. Our Lord could not be envious of a being capable of sin. The Dalai Lama nodded slowly.
One of our Zen masters, a man named Ikkyu, once wrote a poem to that effect. All the sins committed in the three worlds will fade and disappear together with myself.
Cardinal Mustafa waited a moment, but when no more poem was forthcoming, he said, Which three worlds was he speaking of, Your Holiness?
This was before space flight, said the boy, shifting slightly on his cushioned throne. The three worlds are the past, present, and future.
Very nice, said the cardinal from the Holy Office. Behind him, his aide, Father Farrell, was staring at the boy with something like cold distaste.
But we Christians do not believe that sin, or the effects of sin, or the accountability for sin, for that matter, end with one's life, Your Holiness.
Precisely, the boy smiled. It is for this reason that I am curious why you extend life so artificially through your cruciform creature, he said. We feel that the slate is washed clean with death. You feel that it brings judgment. Why defer this judgment?
We view the cruciform as a sacrament given to us by our Lord Jesus Christ, Cardinal Mustafa said softly. This judgment was first deferred by our Savior's sacrifice on the cross, God Himself accepting the punishment for our sins, allowing us the option of everlasting life in heaven if we so choose it. The cruciform is another gift from our Savior, perhaps allowing us time to set our houses in order before that final judgment.
Ah, yes, sighed the boy. But perhaps Ikkyu meant that there are no sinners, that there is no sin, that our lives do not belong to us.
Precisely, Your Holiness, interrupted Cardinal Mustafa, as if praising a slow learner. I saw the regent, the Lord Chamberlain, and others around the throne wince at this interruption. Our lives do not belong to us, but to our Lord and Savior, and to serve Him, to our Holy Mother Church.
Do not belong to us, but belong to the universe, continued the boy. And that our deeds, good and bad, also are property of the universe.
Cardinal Mustafa frowned.
A pretty phrase, Your Holiness, but perhaps too abstract. Without God, the universe can only be a machine, unthinking, uncaring, unfeeling.
Why?
Said the boy.
I beg your pardon, Your Holiness.
Why must the universe be unthinking, uncaring, unfeeling, without your definition of a God?
The child said softly. He closed his eyes.
The morning dew flees away and is no more. Who may remain in this world of ours?
Cardinal Mustafa steepled his fingers and touched his lips as if in prayer or mild frustration.
Very nice, Your Holiness. Ikkyu again.
The Dalai Lama grinned broadly.
No, me. I write a little Zen poetry when I can't sleep.
The priests chuckled. The Nemes creature stared at Ania. Cardinal Mustafa turned toward my friend.
Emananda, he said, do you have an opinion on these weighty matters?
For a second I did not know whom he was addressing, but then I remembered the Dalai Lama's introduction of Ania as Ananda, foremost disciple of the Buddha.
I know another little verse by Ikkyu, which expresses my opinion, she said. More frail and illusory than numbers written on water, our seeking from the Buddha felicity in the afterworld.
Archbishop Breck cleared his throat and joined in the conversation.
That seems clear enough, young lady. You do not think that God will grant our prayers.
Ania shook her head.
I think that he meant two things, Your Eminence. First, that the Buddha will not help us. It isn't in his job definition, so to speak. Secondly, that planning for the afterworld is foolish because we are, by nature, timeless, eternal, unborn, undying, and omnipotent.
The Archbishop's face and neck reddened above his collar.
Those adjectives can be applied only to God, Emananda.
He felt Cardinal Mustafa's glare on him and remembered his place as a diplomat.
Or so we believe, he added lamely.
For a young person and an architect, you seem to know your Zen and poetry, Emananda.
Cardinal Mustafa chuckled, obviously trying to lighten the tone. Are there any other Ikkyu poems you feel might be relevant? Ania nodded.
We come into this world alone. We depart alone. This also is illusion. I will teach you the way. Not to come. Not to go.
That would be a good trick, said Cardinal Mustafa with false joviality. The Dalai Lama leaned forward.
Ikkyu taught us that it is possible to live at least part of our lives in a timeless, spaceless world where there is no birth and death, no coming and going, he said softly. A place where there is no separation in time, no distance in space, no barrier barring us from the ones we love, no glass wall between experience and our hearts.
Cardinal Mustafa stared as if speechless.
My friend, Emananda, also taught me this, said the boy.
For a second, the cardinal's face was twisted by something like a sneer. He turned toward Ania. I would be pleased if the young lady would teach me, teach us all, this clever conjurer's trick, he said sharply.
I hope to, said Ania.
Radamanth Nemes took a half-step toward my friend. I set my hand in my cape, lightly touching the firing stud of the flashlight laser. The regent tapped a gong with a cloth-wrapped stick. The Lord Chamberlain hurried forward to escort us out. Ania bowed to the Dalai Lama, and I clumsily did likewise. The audience was over. I danced with Ania in the great echoing reception hall, to the music of a 72-piece orchestra with the lords and ladies, priests and plenipotentiaries of Tian Shan, the mountains of heaven, all watching from the edges of the dance floor or wheeling around us in shared motion to the music. I remember dancing with Ania, dining again before midnight at the long tables constantly restocked with food, and then dancing again. I remember holding her tight as we moved together around the dance floor. I do not remember ever having danced before, at least when I was sober, but I danced this night, holding Ania close to me as the torchlight from the crackling braziers dims and the oracle casts skylight shadows across the parquet floors. It is in the wee hours of the morning, and the older guests have retired. All the monks and mayors and elder statesmen, except for the Thunderbolt Sow, who has laughed and sung and clapped along with the orchestra for every Racine quadrille, tapping her slippered feet on the polished floors. And there are only 400 or 500 determined celebrants remaining in the great shadowy space, while the band plays slower and slower pieces, as if their musical mainspring is wearing down. I confess that I would have gone off to bed hours earlier if it were not for Ania. She wants to dance. So dance we do, moving slowly, her small hand in my large one, my other hand flat on her back, feeling her spine and strong muscles under my palm through the thin silk of the dress, her hair against my cheek, her breasts soft against me, the curve of her skull against my neck and chin. She seems slightly sad, but still energetic, still celebrating. Private audiences had ended many hours ago, and word had spread that the Dalai Lama had gone to bed before midnight. But we last celebrants partied on. Lomo Dondrup, our flyer friend, laughing and pouring champagne and rice beer for everyone. Labsang Samten, the Dalai Lama's little brother, leaping over the ember-filled braziers at some point. The serious Tromo Trochi of Domu suddenly metamorphosing into a magician in one corner, doing tricks with fire and hoops and levitations. And then the Dorji Famo singing one clear, slow a cappella solo in a voice so sweet that it haunts my dreams to this day. And finally, the scores of others joining in the oracle song as the orchestra prepares to wrap up the evening's celebration before the pre-dawn begins to fade the night sky. Suddenly the music ends in mid-bar. The dancers stop. Ania and I lurch to a stop and look around. There has been no sign of the pack's guests for hours, but suddenly one of them, Radamanth Nemes, emerges from the shadows of the Dalai Lama's curtained alcove. She has changed her uniform and is now dressed all in red. There are two others with her, and for a moment I think they are the priests. But then I see that the two figures dressed in black are near copies of the Nemes thing. Another woman and a man, both in black combat suits, both with limp black bangs hanging down on pale foreheads, both with eyes of dead amber. The trio moves through the frozen dancers toward Anea and me. Instinctively, I put myself between my friend and the things, but the Nemes male and its other sibling begin to move around us, flanking us. I pull Anea close behind me, but she steps to my side. The frozen dancers make no noise. The orchestra remains silent. Even the moonlight seems stilled to solid shafts in the dusty air. I remove the flashlight laser and hold it at my side. The primary Nemes thing shows small teeth. Cardinal Mustafa steps from the shadows and stands behind her. All four of the pack's creatures hold their gaze on Anea. For a moment, I think that the universe has stopped, that the dancers are literally frozen in time and space, that the music hangs above us like icy stalactites, ready to shatter and fall. But then I hear the murmur through the crowd, fearful whispers, a hiss of anxiety. There is no visible threat, only four PAX guests moving out across the ballroom floor with Anea as the locus of their closing circle. But the sense of predators closing on their prey is too strong to ignore, as is the scent of fear through the perfume and powder and cologne. "Why wait?" says Radamanth Nemes, looking at Anea but speaking to someone else, her siblings perhaps, or the cardinal. "I think," says Cardinal Mustafa and freezes. Everyone freezes. The great horns near the entrance arch have blown with the bass rumble of continental crusts shifting. No one is there in the alcoves to blow them. The bone and brass trumpets bracket the endless one-note rumbling of the horns. The great gong vibrates on the bone conduction level. There is a rustle and stifled outcry across the dance floor, in the direction of the escalators, the anteroom, and the curtained entrance arch. The thinning crowds there are parting wider, moving aside like furrowed soil ahead of a steel plow. Something is moving behind the closed curtains of the anteroom. Now something has passed through the curtains, not so much parting them as severing them. Now something is glinting in oracle light and gliding across the parquet floors, gliding as if floating centimeters above the floor, glinting in the dying light of the moon. Tatters of red curtain hang from an impossibly tall form, 3 meters at least, and there are too many arms emerging from the folds of that crimson robe. It looks as if the hands hold steel blades. The dancers move away more quickly, and there is a general and audible intake of breath. Lightning silently supersedes the moonlight and strobes off polished floors, eclipsing the oracle with retinal echoes. When the thunder arrives some long seconds later, it is indistinguishable from the low, bone-shaking rumble of the still-reverberating horns in the entrance hall. The shrike glides to a halt 5 paces from Anea and me, 5 paces from the Nemes thing, 10 paces from each of the Nemes siblings frozen in their act of circling us, 8 paces from the cardinal. It occurs to me that the shrike, shrouded in its dangling red curtain tatters, resembles nothing so much as a chrome and bladed caricature of Cardinal Mustafa in his crimson robe. The Nemes clones in their black uniforms look like shadows of stilettos against the walls. Somewhere in one of the shadowed corners of the great reception hall, a tall clock slowly strikes the hour. 1, 2, 3, 4. It is, of course, the number of inhuman killing machines standing before and behind us. It has been more than 4 years since I have seen the shrike, but its presence is no less terrible and no more welcome despite its intercession here. The red eyes gleam like lasers under a thin film of water. The chrome steel jaws are parted to show row upon row of razor teeth. The thing's blades, barbs, and cutting edges emerge from the enfolding red curtain robe in scores of places. It does not blink. It does not appear to breathe. Now that the gliding has stopped, it is as motionless as a nightmare sculpture. Radamanth Nemes is smiling at it. Still holding the silly flashlight laser, I remember the confrontation on God's Grove years ago. The Nemes thing had gone silver and blurry and simply disappeared, reappearing next to 12-year-old Ania without warning. It had planned to cut off my friend's head and carry it away in a burlap bag, and it would have done so had not the shrike appeared then. The Nemes thing could do so now without hope of my reacting in time. These things moved outside of time. I know the agony of a parent watching its child step into the path of a speeding ground car, unable to move in time to protect her. Superimposed on this terror is the pain of a lover unable to protect his beloved. I would die in a second to protect Ania from any of these things, including the shrike. Indeed, may die in a second, in less than a second. But my death will not protect her. I grind my molars in frustration. Moving only my eyes, afraid that I will precipitate the slaughter if I move a hand or head or muscle, I see that the shrike is not staring at Ania or the primary Nemes thing. It is staring directly at John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa. The frog-faced priest must feel the weight of this blood-red gaze, for the cardinal's complexion has gone a pure white above the red of his robe. Ania moves now. Stepping to my left side, she slips her right hand in my empty left one and squeezes my fingers. It is not a child's request for reassurance. It is a signal of reassurance to me. "You know how it will end," she says softly to the cardinal, ignoring the Nemes things as they coil like cats ready to pounce. The Grand Inquisitor licks his thick lips.
"No, I do not. There are the three of—"
"You know how it will end," interrupts Ania, her voice still soft. "You are on Mars." "Mars, I think? What the hell does Mars have to do with anything?" Lightning flickers again through the skylight, throwing wild shadows. The faces of the hundreds of terror-frozen revelers are like white ovals painted on black velvet around us. I realize in a flash of insight as sudden and illuminating as the lightning that the metaphysical biosphere of this world, Zen-evolved or not, is riddled with Tibetan myth-inspired demons and malevolent spirits. Cancerous Nian earth spirits. Sadag, lords of the soil who haunt builders who disturb their realms. Tsen, red spirits who live in rocks. Gyalpo, spirits of dead kings who have failed their vows, dead, deadly, dressed all in pale armor. Dud spirits, who are so malevolent that they feed only on human flesh and wear black beetle skin. Mamo, female deities as ferocious as unseen riptides. Matrika sorceresses of charnel grounds and cremation platforms, first sensed by a whiff of their carrion breath. Grahas planetary deities that cause epilepsy and other violent thrashing illnesses. Nojin guardians of wealth in the soil, death to diamond miners, and a score more of night things, teethed things, clawed things, and killing things. Lomo and the others have told me the stories well and often. I look at the white faces staring in shock at the shrike and the Nemes creatures and think, this night will not be so strange in the telling for these people.
"The demon cannot vanquish all three of them," says Cardinal Mustafa, saying the word demon aloud even as I think the word. I realize that he is speaking about the shrike. Ania ignores the comment.
"It will harvest your cruciform first," she says softly. "I cannot stop it from doing that." Cardinal Mustafa's head jerks back as if he has been slapped. His pale countenance grows visibly paler. Taking their cue from Radamanth Nemes, the clone siblings coil tighter as if building energy towards some terrible transformation. Nemes has returned her black gaze to Ania, and the creature is smiling so broadly now that her rearmost teeth are visible.
"Stop!"
cries Cardinal Mustafa, and his shout echoes from the skylight and floor. The great horns cease rumbling. Revelers clutch one another in a rustling of fingernails on silk. Nemes flashes the cardinal a look of malevolent loathing and near defiance.
Stop!
Screams the Pax Holy Man again, and I realize that he is talking to his own creatures first and foremost.
I invoke the command of Albedo and the Corps by the authority of the three elements. I command thee!
This last desperate scream has the cadence of a shouted exorcism, some profound ritual, but even I can tell that it is not Catholic or Christian. It is not the Shrike being invoked under an iron grip of talismanic control here. It is his own demons. Nemes and her siblings slide backward on the parquet floor as if pulled by invisible strings. The clone male and clone female move around us until they join Nemes in front of Mustafa. The cardinal smiles, but it is a tremulous gesture.
My pets will not be unleashed until we speak again. I give my word as a prince of the church, unholy child. Do I have your word that this...
He gestures toward the bladed shrike in its velvet tatters.
This demon will not stalk me until then.
Anea appears as calm as she has through the entire incident. I do not control it, she says. Your only safety is to leave this world in peace. The cardinal is eyeing the shrike. The man seems poised to leap away if the tall apparition flexes so much as a finger blade. Nemes and her ilk continue standing between him and the shrike.
What assurance have I, he says, that the thing will not follow me into space or back to Pacham?
None, says Anea. The Grand Inquisitor points a long finger at my friend.
We have business here that has nothing to do with you, he says sharply. But you will never leave this world. I swear this to you by the bowels of Christ.
Anea returns his gaze and says nothing. Mustafa turns and stalks away with a swish of his red robe and a rasp of his slippers on the polished floor. The Nemes things back all the way across the floor while following him, the male and female clones holding their gazes on the shrike, Nemes piercing Anea with her stare. They pass through the curtained tent of the Dalai Lama's private portal and are gone. The shrike stays where it is, lifeless, its four arms frozen in front of it, finger blades catching the last drops of oracle light before the moon moves behind the mountain and is lost. Revelers begin moving toward the exits on a wave of whispers and exclamations. The orchestra thumps, clangs, and whistles as instruments are packed in a hurry and dragged or carried away. Anea continues holding my hand as a small circle remains around us.
Buddha's ass! Cries Lomo Dondrup, and strides over to the shrike, testing his finger against a metallic thorn rising from the thing's chest. I see blood on his finger in the dimming light. Fantastic! Cries Lomo, and swigs from a goblet of rice beer.
The Dorji Famo moves to Anea's side. She takes my friend's left hand, goes to one knee, and sets Anea's palm against her wrinkled forehead. Anea removes her hand from mine as she takes the thunderbolt sow gently by the arms and helps her rise. No, whispers Anea.
Blessed one, whispers the Dorji Famo. Amata, immortal one. Arhat, perfected one. Samasambuddha, fully awakened one. Command us and teach us the Dhamma.
No, snaps Anea, still gentle with the old woman as she pulls her to her feet but stern of countenance. I will teach you what I know and share what I have when the time arrives. I can do no more. The hour for myth has passed. My friend turns, takes my hand and leads us across the dance floor, past the immobile shrike, toward the tattered curtains and unmoving escalator. Former revelers part for our passing as swiftly as they had for the shrike. We pause at the top of the steel stairs. Lanterns grow in the hallway to our sleeping rooms far below us.
Thank you, says Anea, looking up at me with her brown eyes moist.
What? I say stupidly.
For... why, I don't understand.
Thank you for the dance, she says, and reaches up to kiss me softly on the lips.
The electricity of her touch makes me blink. I gesture back toward the roiling crowd behind us, the dance floor empty of the shrike now, at the Potala guards rushing into the echoing space, and at the curtained alcove through which Mustafa and his creatures have disappeared. We can't sleep here tonight, kiddo. Nemus and the other two will...
Uh-uh, says Ania. They won't. Trust me on this. They won't come creeping down the outside wall and across our ceiling tonight. In fact, they'll all be leaving their gompa and shuttling straight up to their ship in orbit. They'll be back, but not tonight.
I sigh. She takes my hand.
Are you sleepy? She says softly.
Of course I am sleepy. I am exhausted beyond words. Last night seems days and weeks away, and I had only 2 or 3 hours light sleep then because of... Not a bit, I say. Ania smiles and leads the way back to our sleeping chamber.